of Aaron and Polly. I'm Aaron.
This is Paul.
And welcome to another exciting episode of Funny Books with just the two of us.
I know. It's like we're rewinding in time 15 years to when it was just us before the kids came in, you know,
and ruined everything. You know what it is, you know, we just wore out the guys with all of that March Madness. And, you know, they're having to sleep in, you know, get some naps, you know, to recover from all of the March Madness hijinks.
They didn't carve up like we did.
Yeah. Yeah, you got to carve up.
Yeah. If you're gonna go through three episodes of March Madness, you got to be prepared. That's what we told them. But
now, kids. I'm not setting out to relitigate the decisions in March Madness. Okay.
Yes.
But you know, I did not approach the Bibbo Brainiac match appropriately. I think had I approached it differently, that it would have been a different outcome. And so while we're here, Paul, I would like to run it by you and see if it would have changed your mind.
Okay, sure. Okay? I'm open.
I made the mistake of saying that Bibbo would get Brainiac all hopped up on soda cola.
And, no, that was, you know, Mr. Smixelpitlick that he was going to get hopped up on soda.
Oh, that's right. Well, I had it that Bibbo was going to, you know, take Brainiac, right?
Yes.
I think had I approached it as Bibbo takes Brainiac to the Ace of Clubs, you know, his club.
Yes.
And gets him drunk. Drinking contest. And of course, Brainiac is not going to beat Bibbo in a drinking contest.
His intellect will not know what to do with
that's
all
right.
that liquor.
That's right. With all them beers. And so I think that's how Bibbo beats Brainiac.
Well, you should have said that last.
I know. My bad.
Now Bibbo is gone, defeated by Brainiac. And
yeah,
now,
martyred.
Would Bibbo then have been able to defeat the Eradicator?
Well, yeah. Yeah, he would have been.
it would have taken him to the Ace of Clubs. Bibbo versus the Invisible Woman. That could have been our ending.
That's right.
Well, maybe next time.
Maybe. At the rematch.
Yeah, in the what if version.
That's right. Well, you know, Paul, you know, after you know, all of that March Madness, I recovered, you know, I celebrated and recovered by watching the last half of the final season of Yellowstone. I'd been putting it off because I was the bloom was kind of off the rose for me with Yellowstone. And I needed to watch it, but I kind of felt like I might be hate watching it.
Okay.
I will say it was a lot better than I thought it was going to be.
Yeah, I honestly thought it ended well. My main gripe is what they did with Colby.
Yeah, I hated that. That was rough. But you knew, I mean, the minute he tells Teeter that he loves her, you're like, oh, Colby, what have you done? You're going to die now. Because, I mean, that is just the hallmark sign. I was just like, oh, I mean, I saw that coming so hard. And when he came in to the horse stall, oh, Colby, don't go in there. Let Carter do it.
Let Carter die.
Yeah, that's right. Just let Carter die. I was just, oh, man. I just felt like that was written all over the wall that Colby was going to die.
But no, we did not get our Jellystone podcast set up, but maybe in time for the spinoff.
Yeah, apparently there's going to be a Beth and Rip spinoff.
Mm-hmm. I'm actually hearing multiple spinoff opportunities, so we'll see.
You know, so I very much enjoyed, first off, the last half of the final season of Yellowstone was a great big screw you to Kevin Costner.
Oh, yes.
You know, because you know, you have him die like a bitch, and you can't tell me that wasn't aimed directly at Kevin Costner.
Oh,
right.
And then just, you know, like defile the corpse.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, just aimed directly at him. But one of the things I really liked is how quickly things happened. You know, like you open the season with John Dutton dead, you know, clearly a faked suicide. But you're episode two, and you know, you've already learned who all's done everything. And it is Jamie's girlfriend, I forget her name, but you know, she's the one who orchestrated it all. And, you know, she's trying to get a hold of the guys that she you know, organized it with, because word's gotten out that it's been opened up as a homicide investigation. And she is murdered, you know, assassinated before the end of the episode. I mean, I was like, I like Jamie, I shouted out when it happened. Unlike Jamie, I didn't descend into tears. But it was amazing how quickly that happened. Of course, they only had, what, six episodes, you know, so it was going to happen fast. But I was really impressed that they didn't string that out longer.
Agreed. You know, and they did, they got a lot done in these six episodes, in the final six episodes. And, you know, what's funny is they still found time for some navel gazing.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, the guest musicians, I was like, come on. You know, I just really can't stand that stuff. One of the things that I found really annoying about the this final part of the last season, I have been waiting since the beginning of this show to see what a badass Casey is. And you finally get to see it. He didn't have to kill anybody. All he's got to do is just ooze danger. And, you know, the sitting in the guy's back seat with a silenced gun on his preteen daughter. I was like, this is fantastic. You know, and his daughter is crying. The guy's daughter is crying. And Casey's like, yeah, you should cry. You should be scared. Like, holy crap.
Yeah. I mean, we saw very few glimpses of Casey being a badass. But I did like that. He just, like, his connections, basically.
Yeah.
You know, they went through all this effort to be covert about killing John Dutton, and Casey's just like, let me make one phone call.
That's
literally
right.
One phone call. That's right. I got this.
Well, and I love the, you know, you did a couple of years on special teams. I did 12.
Yeah.
Yeah. I thought it was really well done. Again, you know, I felt like some of that stuff, I was like, golly, I wish that we'd seen this sooner in the show. You know?
Yeah.
And then the only other thing was that, you know, John Dutton for four and a half seasons, was fighting to keep the ranch. The minute he's dead, okay, we got to sell the ranch. We got to do something with this ranch. This ranch has got to go. I mean, there was nobody holding on to his dream. And I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah, what was interesting for me is, you know, apparently Kevin Costner was originally supposed to die either in the first or second seasons.
Mm-hmm.
But he enjoyed it so much that they just kept, you know, finding a reason. Yeah. So basically, these final three seasons were never supposed to have Kevin Costner. He was supposed to die. And everything that unfolded over these last six or eight episodes, was supposed to unfold, you know, over the entirety of the show. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of interesting just how much... It just goes to show you, decompressed storytelling.
Yeah.
You know, when they don't want to do decompressed storytelling, they can knock that shit out in eight episodes. But if they want to do decompressed storytelling, they can do 2 years worth of television before they even get to the story they wanted to tell.
Right. Right.
But it was a good, you know, I will say it ended strong. It ended in a way that I felt was, it ended for me exactly the way it would have. Like, it checked off every box. The Yellowstone Ranch is now back with the Native Americans. John Dutton is dead. Jamie's dead. Casey has his own ranch with his family. Beth and Rip, you know, have their own ranch together. You know, like, in my mind, it just kind of like, it checked off every box that it needed to check off.
Yeah. Yeah. I was very amused with some of the dialogue, and mostly from Beth, you know, like,
usually.
When she calls Rip and, you know, he's like, hey, I'm in the truck with the guys and, you know, maybe you need to, you know, let me get down to Texas and see what the temperature is. She goes, I am going to get in the car and I'm going to drive there and I am going to fuck you like I won you in the county fair. I died. That line has stayed with me. And the hilarious thing is that Rip is in a car with a bunch of guys and what's his name, Ethan, to his right. He's like, every word I heard, every word. Good times. good times. Yeah. And then her observation, you know, she's going around, you know, talking to people about their feelings and you know, how to resolve stuff. And she's like, you know, things are pretty screwed up when, you know, I'm the family therapist, which I'm like, yeah. But yeah, I thought it was pretty good. I thought it ended a whole lot better than I thought it would.
Yeah, agreed.
But I think Landsman is poised to be the next Yellowstone. It was so good.
It was. It started so good. I'm very concerned as to where it's going to go. But you know, we've still got Yellowstone 1923.
Mm-hmm. I'm an episode back on that one. I didn't watch this week's episode.
I have not even started season two yet.
Oh, it's so good. Except Spencer's still wandering his way to Montana.
Come on.
I know. It's driving me batshit.
I mean, come on.
Yeah.
I get it. But, like, they got to just start planning, like, hey, can you just end this thing and come up with the next thing instead of dragging this thing out?
Yeah. Well, they got to know that he is the character that everyone is the most interested in. You can't go two seasons and he's not there with the people. And that's actually kind of my objection to Yellowstone is it's not my objection. It's just that I feel really bad for the actor who plays Jamie or played Jamie because, you know, once they kind of declared him two seasons ago as the family villain, he didn't get to be part of the ensemble anymore.
Yeah.
You know, he was always off on his own thing. He didn't get to work with all the rest of the cast. You know, he didn't get to hang out with Rip and Casey and Beth. You know, his scenes when they were with the family, it was him and Beth and usually him getting his ass kicked by Beth.
Yeah.
You know, I always felt kind of felt bad for him. That he didn't get to play with the other actors nearly as much. And, you know, that's kind of how I feel about Spencer on 1923. He didn't get to share any screen time with Harrison Ford, you know.
That's true.
And that's got to be frustrating. You know if you're in a show with the Harrison Ford, it would be nice to say, hey, yeah, I shared some scenes with the Harrison Ford.
You know, and for what it's worth, Harrison Ford, don't get me wrong, he's in good health, he's doing fine, but like either him or Helen Mirren are getting younger.
You're right.
So like, you can't drag this out, but so long. Plus, 1923, you know, it was 1 year.
Yeah.
Unless you're going to change the name of the show to 1924. Like, let's wrap this shit up.
Yeah. Well, you know, I am not a Harry Potter fan, but I marvel at the news that John Lithgow was cast as Dumbledore.
Yeah.
And, you know, for the new Harry Potter TV series made for Max. And it's going to be one of their prestige television shows, just like Game of Thrones. Mm-hmm. John Lithgow is 80 years old. Yep. Aren't there like 7 books?
Well, he actually was very open about that. He said, you know, this is basically it for me. This is going to inform basically the rest of my life.
Well, but most people don't live till they're 87.
Oh, he's planning on it. But
I understand that.
Uh-huh. The first two Dumbledores died too, so you know, and the first one died before they filmed the third or fourth movie.
Uh huh.
So I'm not. John Lithgow is a legend, and
he's an American treasure.
I want him to live forever. I love John Lithgow. However, it's not something they haven't dealt with before.
True, fair, but I'm just like, you know, that's. If Max is producing television timely, that's one book a season.
Yeah.
And a season being a year. But they never do that. There's usually 18 months between these things. Anyway, I saw that. And I'm like, huh.
Yeah. They got to really, you know, keep it cooking if they want to try to get it out.
Yeah.
Timely.
Yeah.
But same with the kids, right? Like these kids are supposed to. I mean, it worked. They figured it out with the movies. But, you know.
Yeah.
You got the kids are. Yeah, it's supposed to be 7 years in these kids' lives.
Yep.
I mean, except the kids won't die, in theory.
In theory. So we had a big Marvel MCU announcement.
A huge MCU announcement. So, you know, there was a big rumor that Marvel would make an announcement, and they did it in a 5-hour live broadcast on YouTube, which you can honestly just see 30, you know, the 22nd version, but they announced, you know, at least the first round or maybe the people who have officially signed, or maybe the people who are officially already filming. I'm not entirely sure. But they made a pretty significant cast announcement for Avengers Doomsday with, you know, mostly not a lot of surprises. So they kind of announced a lot of people who are already in the MCU. So you have Chris Hemsworth, Anthony Mackie, Sebastian Stan, you know, Paul Rudd, they also Simu Liu, Shang-Chi, Florence Pugh, but they also had the cast of the Fantastic Four as part of the announcement.
Right.
They also had Namor as part of the announcement. And then they
I needed any more of that guy.
Right.
Yeah.
They also had a couple of surprises. They had Kelsey Grammer, reprising his role as Beast. They also announced Tom Hiddleston from Loki, which, you know, given where we left him, was a bit of a surprise for me. But we also had Sir Patrick Stewart, Sir Ian McKellen, Alan Cumming, Rebecca Romijn Jr., James Marsden, and Channing Tatum as part of the announcement as well. So, you know, this is very much, you know, bringing back. What's interesting to me is bringing back that original X-Men cast,
right?
Not the James McAvoy version, at least not announced. So we got, you know, that was, you know, and of course Robert Downey Jr. as Dr. Doom. But, you know, pretty big announcement. You know, obviously some names notably missing. Tom Holland wasn't mentioned. Chris Evans wasn't mentioned. Neither Deadpool nor Wolverine were mentioned as part of the announcement. And so, you know, it could be that they're leaving them as a surprise or waiting for later or what. But I think it was something like 27 names in total were announced in that video. I'm excited. I'm very curious to see what the intent of this movie is. This phase of Marvel has been really hit or miss. But I think one of the things that the Russos are saying is that unlike Avengers Endgame, where they were ending a saga, they feel like this is more a beginning of a saga. So that's an interesting, you know, take. Yeah. I'm curious to see where it goes.
And this is a two-part film, right? Isn't it? It's going to be Doomsday, and then the next one is
Secret War.
Yeah. It would not surprise me to find that Deadpool and Wolverine and Spider-Man are in the next movie. I think They've got to hold something back. Because otherwise, you know, you've just got these little vignettes of people. I saw a thing where they were promoting this and they're like, you know, all the superstars for, you know, Avengers Doomsday. And I was like, the guy who plays Namor, the chick who's playing Black Panther. I think superstar is, a bit of a stretch. You know, for some of these guys, I mean, there are some of these guys that is just not an announcement. I mean, who cares about the guy who plays Namor? You know, I really hated him in that movie. You know, I just did not think it was a very good film, and largely because I did not care for his character.
Yeah, agreed. So, you know, what is interesting, though, is, you know, Ryan Coogler is doing the rounds right now.
Mm-hmm.
And he's directed the first two Black Panther movies, and he's talking like he's doing the third one.
You know,
he's
the third Black Panther.
The third Black Panther. He's been answering some questions almost as if it's a foregone conclusion that there will be a Black Panther 3 and that he will be at the helm. So
I hope there is a Black Panther 3, and I hope it is really good, because Black Panther 2, not so much.
Yeah, agreed. I really wanted to like Black Panther 2 as much as I liked Black Panther 1. I had high hopes.
Same. And, you know, I frequently will see a movie and I'm not in the right mood for it and I don't enjoy it. But I rewatch that darn thing and I hated it every bit as much as the first time I saw it. And the issue is not that you're sitting the movie going, man, I wish, you know, the real Black Panther was here. Chadwick Boseman, I wish he was here. That's not the issue. The issue is just not a good film. And the woman who plays, it's not Shuri, who plays his sister. I can't remember his sister's name.
Oh, Letitia Wright.
Yeah. It's the fact that she's just doesn't have the charisma to hold the camera like Chadwick Boseman did, you know, and you've got it. You need, they're called stars for a reason, Paul.
Yeah.
You know, and she just didn't have it. like Chadwick Boseman did. And, you know, the MCU is populated by actors that can really hold the camera. You know, I think Sebastian Stan is one of those people. You know, Anthony Mackie to a certain degree, certainly Robert Downey Jr., certainly Chris Evans, certainly Chris Hemsworth, certainly Scarlett Johansson. You know, these are all people with a ton of charisma, and the actor that played the new Black Panther just did not have that. And that whole cast was populated by folks trying to own the camera, and they just never did.
Yeah. So it's a, you know, well, I think hopefully they've got a plan for Black Panther 3 that'll get that
same. Yeah. I hope the same because I want to like it. I love the first movie
and I love the character and the same concept.
And I like the world they've created. I like everything about it. I just didn't like that movie. So, well, I am one of those people who's excited about Avengers Doomsday. I'm excited about Thunderbolts. I am excited about Fantastic Four. I mean, I think the MCU is going to have a really big year. I know I've said that before. I'm going to say it again. I think the MCU is going to have a really big year. And you know they're going to have a really big year because Sue Storm won March Madness.
We knew it. We knew it was happening.
That's right.
You know, like Sue Storm. And it's a big Fantastic Four kind of date for us in general. Because, yeah, you know, obviously they're going to be, we've got Fantastic Four coming up. Avengers Doomsday features the Fantastic Four. And we read two Fantastic Four heavy comics this week. One World Under Doom, issue two, came out, you know, featuring the Fantastic Four and, you know, and their onslaught on Doom as he's presenting to the world from the United Nations, because what they have planned is that, you know, Doom, his main weakness is his, you know, being made to look bad, his hubris. And so they want to make him look bad, cause him to lose his cool, and you know, and then the world will turn against him. But it doesn't work out for them. Not only does it not work out for them, you know, we have a, you know, my favorite part of issue two is that Valeria Richards, you know, goes and visits Uncle Doom for the first half of the issue and has a frank conversation about Doom's intent, Doom's plan. And I thought that was really well done. I you know, the relationship between those two characters is really strong. You know, and then we've got the big battle between the, you know, Fantastic Four and Doom, which ends with Ben Grimm no longer the Thing. Well, no longer rock form. So lots happened in issue two. Aaron, what'd you think?
You know, I like you, like yourself, I really enjoyed the scenes between Valeria and Doom. I think that relationship is super interesting. And I thought it was well captured here, but it was clear from the jump that there was a setup on that Doom was kind of prepared for the Fantastic Four. Mm-hmm. You know, that he knew that him giving this presentation at the UN was going to be too much for them. And I just felt like Reed walked right into it. And the whole time I'm like, you know, Reed should be smarter than this. And it was almost like a spell had been cast on him to make him just a little bit more stupid. Cause I wasn't buying that Reed would make such a huge mistake, and it would all be captured by the public, you know?
Yeah.
The trap didn't seem clever enough for Reed to fall victim to.
I felt, for what it's worth, I felt like the entire plan was a bit juvenile.
Yeah.
Like, hey, let's go embarrass Dr. Doom. That'll make him reveal his true colors. And I'm like,
agreed.
It felt a little silly.
Yeah, it felt juvenile.
It did. And which is unusual because, again, you know, the parts with Valeria and Doom were written so well, but, you know, the main story, you know, the action story just felt a little silly to me. But it overall, I enjoyed the book. Don't get me wrong. It felt like a tale from yesteryear almost.
Yeah.
And I actually have that comment about both of the books that I read this, both of the Fantastic Four books.
Did you read the tie-in issue of the Fantastic Four?
Oh, I have not.
Oh.
Well, I did not even purchase it. Let me clarify.
It was terrible.
Oh.
It was terrible, Paul. It was Fantastic Four issue number 30, picking up right after Doom de-things Ben Grimm, right? So, you know, he has done the thing that Reed Richards has never been able to do successfully for any length of time. He was able to transform the thing back into his human form, Ben Grimm, and, quote, make it permanent, right? And instead of Ben Grimm being Ben Grimm about it, he spends the entire book moping that, you know, he's sad because he's not the thing anymore. He needs to be strong. He needs to be powerful. Instead of rejoicing in the fact that he is now a human and he can, live like man and woman with his wife. There was never any joy in the transformation. It was all, I'm not the thing anymore. I've got to be this big rock guy. Whereas we've seen Ben transform before, and he is always so thankful at those transformations and any promise that he doesn't have to be the thing again. And when he's decided, you know, I still want to be a member of the Fantastic Four, Reed made him a suit of thing armor, right?
Yeah.
You know, he has always found a way to participate, but in this, he was, you know, very much, I am worthless without my, you know, super strength and my rock hard hide. You know, I'm nothing if I'm not the thing. And so he goes to the puppet master, right? Alicia Masters' father. So his father-in-law, he goes to him in prison and brings him some of his magic clay and has the puppet master recreate Ben Grimm in a happier form so that he can, you know, be a, quote, better husband. It was just the silliest, stupidest take on this situation. And it was like it was written for 5-year-olds, Paul. I was like, what the hell is going on here? Because I kind of felt let down by the One Nation Under Doom book, issue number 2. I felt let down by the way the Fantastic Four was depicted and how silly the strategy was. And then for it to follow up into the FF book with Ben being a character that we've never seen before. This is not who he is. When he mopes because he's the thing and he can't be a man. But now he's going to mope because he can't be the thing and he's a man. I don't get it.
Yeah, and they're both written by the same author, right? Ryan North, which is a bit concerning because he's also writing the upcoming Fantastic Four book that I was kind of interested in. You know, it's with art by Umberto Ramos, but it continues, you know, he's still the writer on it.
Yeah.
But, you know, One World Under Doom started strong, so I'm going to continue with it. But, yeah, I mean, and for what it's worth, Ryan North also wrote Godzilla versus the Fantastic Four this week.
Yeah.
With art by John Romita Jr. Now, in this one, I felt like the throwback storytelling style was intentional, right? Intentionally nostalgic and throwback to...
I agree.
Because it's set in the 60s. And it works a little better in that capacity. It, you know, but it doesn't necessarily work for modern storytelling like it doesn't, you know, for the One World Under Doom and Fantastic Four books.
Yeah, I agree. But
what does not work about that Godzilla book is that John Romita Jr. art.
Oh, man, it does really, really blow.
it is so, you know, because the book itself is fine. It's a fun Fantastic Four versus Godzilla book. The writing, like I said, you know, despite being the same author, you know, not bad at all. But the John Romita Jr. art is atrocious. And I'm a John Romita Jr. fan. You know, I'm an apologist for John Romita Jr. generally, but you don't put him on a Godzilla book if he draws Godzilla so badly.
Yeah.
And he draws Godzilla like Godzilla. I mean, you know, John Romita Jr.'s style is I'm going to meet my deadlines. you know, Godzilla's like on a diet. Or, you know, like the art is just not good in this book, especially on Godzilla. I mean, the Fantastic Four are fine. But when 50% of your book is Godzilla destroying a city, it's not well done art.
Well, and the sad thing is that there is a really cool idea here, and it's that King Ghidorah becomes Galactus's herald.
Yeah.
And I'm sorry
that Godzilla gets the power cosmic.
Yeah, and I'm sorry, that's brilliant.
Yeah.
That's brilliant. And I loved it. I was like, okay, here we go. And then, you know, it's just not drawn very well, which makes it a whole lot less cool.
I feel like he was looking at a Godzilla toy and just like posing it.
I think he was looking, because it's set in the 60s, I think he modeled his Godzilla after the Godzilla of that period. But, you know, because John Romita Jr. is just not the artist that he used to be, Godzilla looks rather clownish.
Yeah. And it's a shame because, again, it's not a bad book, from a storytelling standpoint. It's actually quite fun. I like that it's set in the 60s. It ties back to the original Godzilla movie and to what was happening in the Fantastic Four book of that era.
Yep.
So it's really well done from that capacity. It's just that the lead character is drawn so poorly.
Yeah.
I think I don't know if it's different creative teams. I'm assuming it's different creative teams with every book. Maybe it's
I believe current. It is.
But the next one is Godzilla versus the Hulk. And I'm looking forward to that one. I mean, I'm looking forward to this entire series. So even if one's not good, you know, the next one could be. And the covers are pretty gorgeous. I mean, it's a shame because the covers on this book are absolutely beautiful. They have a little Neil Francis Yu cover. They've got some Mark Bagley covers. Nick Bradshaw, who's, kind of the heir apparent to Art Adams, does a cover. But, the interior art was just not strong.
Yeah, agreed.
But Aaron, let's talk about some books from the Distinguished Competition, because it's been a while, my friend, since we've spoken about the Absolute books.
So did you read Absolute Flash?
I am all caught up on every Absolute book currently.
Okay, so my simple review of Absolute Flash is absolute turd.
I will tell you, and this is going to be appalling to you, I did not hate Absolute Flash.
Ugh.
I feel like, for what it's worth, though, I feel like there was far from enough meat on the bone for a first issue. But tell me why you hated it so much.
It's a lot of back and forth in time. It is, which makes it feel not too dissimilar from a regular Flash book these days, right? I did not care for the whole, teen dynamic, you've got Wally West, right? Being the Flash character here, and he is mentored, befriended by Barry Allen, who is the scientist, and, the scientist leads to Wally West getting his powers, but there just didn't seem to be any real connection. It was all sort of vignette in the book. I never really got a sense of why I'm supposed to care about Wally, right?
I think that's kind of what I mean by not enough meat on the bone. Felt like I got the first 10 minutes of a TV show, but I haven't even been introduced to the characters. And yeah. I think that, of all the Absolute issues that I read, of all the Absolute first issues that I read, this is probably the weakest because it provides the least amount of insight character defining of the lead character of the book.
Yeah,
I truly don't know who Wally West is, other than he's an angry kid living on an army base. I don't know why he's there. I don't know, he gets his powers, but I don't, but he's being hunted. I think they're trying to do a little bit of Invincible with this book, because you've got the young Wally West, you've got these, superpowered villain, the rogues are hunting him down. But I don't know, something about it struck me a bit like Invincible or Radiant Black, that they're trying to appeal to that, teenage type character.
Yeah.
But it just doesn't work. It's not as, for what it's worth, I didn't dislike the book. I just did not get, I felt like it was a bunch of setup with no real meat. And I still don't, and I like, with all the first issues that I read, I feel like even though they may have established mysteries, there was still more story to them. And it just doesn't feel like there was enough story in this first issue.
I just feel like there wasn't enough of a hook for me to come back for an issue two, right? There wasn't enough there to say, hey, Aaron, you know, this is worth your, you know, $4.99 for the next issue. Conversely, Martian Manhunter, Absolute Martian Manhunter number one, I thought was brilliant.
Dude, I was going to say the same thing. I'm so glad you read this book. God, I'm like, we didn't coordinate, but yeah. Holy crap, this book was so out of left field.
Uh-huh.
Now, that's going to be my main gripe with it, because I'm like, well, how does this fit in with the rest of the Absolute universe? Well, it's so different.
I will say that that's what's weird about all these books, is that none of them feel like they're in the same world. Yeah, right?
Which is kind of, you know, like when the Absolute universe was announced, I thought it was basically DC's version of Ultimate, right? And it is. Like, these are supposedly the universe created by Darkseid. So this is supposedly all the same universe, and at some point we'll see these characters together.
Yeah.
But the storytelling styles and worlds are so different in a good way, right? It creates diversity and variety in the storytelling. But, you know, there's no, in my mind, there's no house style that connects these books.
And it's not the style that I find jarring between each of them. It's just the setting is so different. You know, I mean, you're like, are they really in the same world? Is the world that Absolute Superman is wandering around in the same as Absolute Wonder Woman and Absolute Batman? Because all three of those seem very different. Right?
Yeah, you're right.
And I would expect Gotham to be extremely different from anything else. But, you know, it seems like, you know, Wonder Woman and Superman should be kind of wandering around in the same space, and they are not. Nor is Absolute Martian Manhunter, which, let me just tell you, that the artwork by Javier Rodriguez is gorgeous.
I got to tell you, it is so good, and it makes me it's almost so good that it makes me want to buy the print version, because there is a piece of this book that is designed for print.
Right.
Where you hold your book up to the sun and you basically see two pages kind of blend together, the art of two pages blend together.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So the last two pages of the book, you know, so right as you go into the last two pages of the book, there's a pause where it says, "Message to my fellow Martians, to activate your Martian vision, please take page 25 of the comic book in your hands and hold it to the light." And basically what the intent is that you are supposed to see this lead character, you know, John, and the Martian Manhunter not only, you know, form from him, but also if you're looking at the last two pages, he's lying on the ground in the lead character's kind of lying on the ground. Almost looks like he's passed out.
Yeah.
But if you hold it up to the sun, you'll see the Manhunter like coming, like clouding out of his body.
Mm.
Like if you look at those two pages together, you know, how you can see how they kind of tie together. For me, I think that's brilliant. You know, and it doesn't work as well digitally, still effective, but right. It would be a very cool effect print wise.
Well, the coloring is amazing on the book. The inks are amazing on the book. And so the storytelling is just wild.
It is.
Yeah.
It's so fascinating. It's so interesting. It almost feels like a Black Label book, right? Like
it does.
Something not tied to any universe. Like I'm reading just a Martian Manhunter miniseries. And, you know, I'm very curious how it's going to tie in to the rest of the Absolute universe. You know, we're six issues in, or seven issues in, I think, on maybe on Absolute Wonder Woman. I know we're at least six issues in on everything. Six issues in on everything. And no mention of any of the other books, no mention of any of the other characters. And that's fine, you know, establish these characters first. But yeah, curious how they'll all tie in. But I'm in, other than, you know, the Flash is the weakest one, by far the weakest spot in the line. But I have enjoyed every book. And, you know, I don't know how current you are on some of these others. But I mean, I truly enjoyed the entire Absolute line right now.
Yeah, Dennis Camp is the writer for Absolute Martian Manhunter. I don't know Dennis Camp, but
I feel like I've seen the name before. I'm just not. Yeah, but I don't feel like.
Well, the notion that, you know, it's not a, you know, green Martian who's come to Earth, right, and, you know, disguises himself as a human to, you know, pass in society and, you know, mingle with the humans. It is an alien intelligence that is inhabiting a human man's mind And the human man doesn't understand what's going on. He just knows that things are different and things are weird. And, you know, why is it if no one's smoking in here, where did all this smoke come from? You know, it's fascinating, the storytelling. You know, John, the main character of the book, is an FBI agent. And, you know, working in investigation, and he's had a serious accident. They keep trying to give him medical leave. And he's like, no, I'm fine. I'm fine. Whereas on the inside of his head, he's like, yeah, I don't think you're fine. You know, it's a really interesting book. I can't wait to see where this goes.
Same here. I think it's fantastic.
Yeah.
So sign me up. Yeah. I both books for me will get second issues, but I continue to read the entire Absolute line.
Well, by far, I think the strongest book in the Absolute line is Absolute Wonder Woman. Every single issue has been a banger.
And have you read the current issue, issue 6?
Yeah, it was great.
It's so great. And the art, you know, they brought in a guest artist. And don't get me wrong, I think the art on the book is normally fantastic.
Yeah.
But they bring in a guest artist who is Mattia De Julius. Mm-hmm. Or Julius, I don't know, because it may be Italian. But the art is just beautiful. It is
stunning.
It's like Michael Janin, kind of similar style art, but it is very Greek gods, mm-hmm. Storytelling. It's so well done.
And the lighting in it is super dramatic. Mm-hmm. You know, the lights and the darks, and it's just amazing. I can't get over how good the story is by Kelly Thompson, and the art in this particular issue by Mattia De Julius is just amazing. Just amazing.
I agree.
And like I said, every single issue has been fantastic. Every single issue.
Now, you're not reading Absolute Batman, am I?
That is correct.
Okay.
I am not reading
Absolute Batman. Which is a shame, because I am quite enjoying Absolute Batman. I think it's done a really good job this first arc, has some really interesting notes to it, and is pretty badass. And I think in the next arc we're getting introduced to Mr. Freeze, and I love the redesigns on these characters. So I'm truly enjoying Absolute Batman, more so than I even expected to.
Well, I'll probably read it collected. I'm not, boycotting it. I didn't enjoy it enough to buy it monthly.
Yeah, agreed. Though I could see that.
And I'm almost at the same place on Absolute Superman. I think it started strong. It is not where I'd like it to be.
Yeah, I think it's very much taking its time.
Yeah.
Even for me, even more so than the rest of the other books, I think this book is just taking its sweet time. I'm enjoying it, and I think so this one's Jason Aaron, the art by Rafa Sandoval. The art's great. For what it's worth, it kind of reads like a Brian Michael Bendis book almost, right?
Yeah.
Like we're taking our time getting to the heart of the story.
And I wish it wouldn't. I kind of ready for it to hurry the hell up.
Yeah.
So, but I overall, I think most of the Absolute books are really good. I think the standouts for me right now are Absolute Wonder Woman and Absolute Martian Manhunter. I just cannot get over it. I was not expecting Martian Manhunter to delight me as it did. And, you know, I always like Javier Rodriguez. I'm going to buy everything Javier Rodriguez does. His artwork is amazing. Oh, and, you know, it's very Ditko-esque. And, you know, I love that sort of effect that he has. There's a surreality to his artwork. Mm-hmm. And I love it. I love it. And to match it with such a innovative style of storytelling and such a great idea, it's just fantastic. Just fantastic. So,
well, and the last of this first line of books, which is Absolute Green Lantern, comes out this coming week.
I'll pick it up. I don't hold out a lot of hope for it. I don't
particularly either, but you know,
I'm willing to be surprised.
Exactly.
But I have not been. I have not enjoyed a Green Lantern book in an awfully long time, Paul. I think we're gonna have to go back to Blackest Night days to talk about a Green Lantern book that I enjoyed. But it's been a long time. Just saying.
Locked. Oh, fingers crossed. Fingers crossed.
But hey, we want to know what you thought. Well, wait a minute. I don't want to know what you thought about this week's books yet, because I want to know, hey, Paul, what's coming out next week?
Well, we by the time you are listening to this podcast, one, you should be all caught up on our our ideology of March Madness recordings, because by the time this book comes out, we will have, or but this episode comes out, Absolute Superman issue 6, Absolute Green Lantern issue 1, Daredevil, Cold Day in Hell, which is kind of a Dark Knight Returns take on Daredevil, will have been released. And next week, as of the time of this recording, we will get the 7th issue of Absolute Batman, which again, it starts introducing Mr. Freeze and features guest artist Marcos Martin. From Marvel Comics, we get a brand new relaunched Amazing Spider-Man issue 1 with writing by Joe Kelly and art by your favorite, John Romita Jr.
I know that's going home for John Romita Jr. He's got a long history with Spider-Man, but ugh.
Well, Aaron, perhaps the biggest release of next week from American Mythology Production, Captain Action versus Al Capone, Vampire.
Oh, God. We have to get that one.
I mean, if it wasn't a $7 cover price, oh my God. I might have, if it was more like a $3.99 cover price,
yeah,
no question, I would buy it just for the morbid curiosity. $7, hopefully $7. There's a preview.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, hey, we want to know what you thought about this week's books. What do you think about the Absolute line? What do you think about the end of Yellowstone? Because it's breaking news on Funny Books with Aaron and Polly. But yeah, give us a shout. ideologyofmadness@gmail.com. And if we use your comments on the show, you could win a coveted valuable Ideology of Madness surprise.
You can also hit us up on social media. IOM Geek on Facebook, Instagram, and X.
What a deal. Well, hey, Paul, let's do this all over one more time.
We will catch everyone then.
Just one more time, though. That's it.
Oh, just done. Yeah, then we're done. don't tease me with a good time. Don't tease me with free Saturdays.
We'll see you next time.
Bye.
Podcast theme music graciously provided by Mark Andrew Pope. For more information, visit markandrewpope.com. Funny Books with Aaron and Polly is a production of ideologyofmadness.com. No Spider-Man clones were harmed in the production of this podcast.